The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Our tax-efficient one-for-all gift cards can make a great bonus for staff. Unpost. Do more.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. Now, we'll start today with the Irish Daily Mail, where the former Fianna Fáil Minister Conor Lennon is all over the front page talking about AIB and his brother, the late Finance Minister Brian Lennon. Conor is revealing that he was the go-between for his brother with the banks. He tells us that AIB was, quote, literally out by billions of euro. Well, we know that in relation to their financial troubles. He goes on to say that his brother had a lot of troubles with their AIB because some of the people within the bank were telling utter untruths publicly about the state of the bank and what was needed to get the bank out of its difficulties. The other thing is, a lot of people around that time were saying things that weren't true publicly. Presumably they were afraid if they said we're up the spout that there would be a run on the bank, and that's what everybody was trying to avoid. Anyway, who's to say? Anyway, interesting also that Conor Lennon has made a new life for himself in Moscow, which sounds very exotic indeed. Now, the Irish Times, Troika's seeking tough post-bailout terms. We might have hoped it was good news. There's only 7 weeks till we officially leave the bailout, but things might be a little trickier than we may have hoped for. The paper tells us that the government is facing tough demands from the Troika in return for an emergency credit line to help prevent any loss of market confidence as we come out of the bailout. And it seems we might be expected to comply with tough conditions, even if we never use the credit line. We read, of course, that the government is on the case to limit the scope of any conditions we might be subject to, but that's not as cut and dried as just leaving the bailout. On the other hand, I presume it removes the possibility of further auction politics for another little while. Anyway, also on the front page, that story about Wicklow County Council and the 355,000 fine. For that tragic story about the death of the two brave firefighters. And for fans of the late Seamus Heaney, there is a real treat. One of the last poems written by Seamus is published today for the first time. It's called In a Field, and it was submitted to his publisher last April. The story behind it is very interesting because it was inspired by a First World War poem by Edward Thomas called As the Team's Head Brass, and that's also on the front of the Observer. As well, I suppose, not surprisingly. The Indo also, texting craze, pressure on our school children. That's about pressures on teenagers to engage in a risky behaviour, such as sending sexually explicit text messages. And this was raised at a child protection conference. And I mean, I know social media is great and there have been great advances, but there have been downsides too. And different budget story, they have that the judges and the politicians will be able to keep the pensions that they are entitled to of up to 115 grand a year. While there's another kind of ceiling of 60,000 for those who actually have private pensions, broadly speaking anyway. Now, Today's Examiner tells us more about the Roma story. The Children's Ombudsman, Emily Logan, has given special powers to investigate the Gardaí involved in the removal of two children from the Roma families in recent days. It also carries a story from the Child Protection Conference about children at risk over fall in social workers. Apparently, there's a whole heap of problems with understaffing. And I know there's been a lot of criticism of the media having got that story and the Gardaí having leaked it to the crime journalists. But if they hadn't, we wouldn't know about this. And it's no bad thing that we do. I think, you know, I don't envy the people what happened to them, and I certainly don't envy them their loss of privacy. But on the other hand, I think it's no bad thing that we do know about these things going on. Anyway, sitting across from me, star of stage, screen and music, supposed to be, not supposed to be, genuinely recognised as the best person in the world with the harmonica, had a most extraordinary life, ran away from home at 12, hospitalised 3 times, evicted from Dublin home, incarcerated and abused, later joined the army, and many more things besides, and a wonderful success. Now, Don Baker, you're more than welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Marie.
Do you know what amazed me going over your story? Like, there were a lot of what we will call very bad things that happened in your life. But as you grew older and you had therapy and you tried to figure out why you were angry or depressed or whatever, it all came back to the trip to hospital as a 6-year-old when you had TB.
Yeah, it's funny that back in those days, I was born in 1950.
Yeah.
And back in those days, your parents weren't allowed to stay with you in hospital. So, with result, I went into James Connolly Memorial Blanchardstown Hospital, and it was a TB hospital back then.
Yeah.
And my mother could only come to see me on Wednesdays and Sundays. So, with result, like, I had like acute anxiety at that age. I was only like 4 or 5. And, you know, just to give you a picture of that, like, my mother would come up to see me on Sunday and she'd say, "Now be a big boy and don't cry when I leave," because I'd scream, you know. And, you know, and I'd scream, she'd leave, I'd be hanging out of her skirt and the nurses would be dragging me off her and back into anxiety again. And they'd say, oh, you know, your mother would be up to see you on Wednesday. What are you crying for? And stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then Wednesday would come, they'd say, your mother would be up to see you on Sunday. So it was just fretting all the time. And it was quite horrific, you know.
Yeah. And did your dad go up to see you?
No, my father never came up to see me at all.
Right. So all those years later, that kind of sense of abandonment,
yeah,
was right at the bottom of a lot of your...
Yeah, I still have it today. I have to watch that, you know, and work on that, you know.
Quite extraordinary. Mind you, isn't it amazing? I mean, we have changed so much the notion that a parent couldn't visit a child in hospital.
Yeah, I don't think they realised back then the damage they could do.
And were you in a children's ward or a mixed ward or what?
I was in a children's ward. But I went back to hospital then some years later, maybe about 9 or 10. And the funny thing was, when I went to be admitted to the same unit, which was Unit 8, I couldn't go in there. And my mother was saying, "Why won't you go in?" I didn't know. It was like buried in the subconscious. I just didn't know. I can't go in there. I just can't do it. So they put me up in Unit 12 with the adults.
Right.
And I was fine with that.
Interesting.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah. And that's where you came across the harmonica.
That's right. There was a gentleman in a bed beside me and he had a TB of the spine. So he was on his back all the time. All he could do was read or play a harmonica. And I really fell in love with the sound. I think I felt lonesome at the time. And I think that the harmonica mirrored to me that sound.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so yeah. There was an immediate attraction.
And so you put the hammer on your mother.
Yeah.
And you started practising at that young age.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point where matron took it off you every night.
Every night she used to take it from me. And then the next morning I'd be outside her office waiting, "Where's my harmonica?" And I'd play it under the covers. We had a rest hour every day. You had to rest for an hour. And I wouldn't rest, I'd be under the blankets playing the harmonica.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah, because people have forgotten what a plague TB was around that time.
Yeah, it was rampant, wasn't it, in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was so different from now, being born in 1950. Like, just thinking this morning about it, nobody had telephones. Well, very few people had. Very few people had a motor car. You know, so, and thinking about Sundays as well, there'd be no shops open. It wasn't like now. You know, we have these garages where you can buy bread and like cigarettes, anything.
More
you
or
want.
Less. Well, all the supermarkets now, yeah. Too. Yeah, yeah.
But back then, they didn't have that. We didn't have that luxury.
That's right. Actually, I remember RTE used to just play a certain type of music on, say, a Good Friday. There would be no programming in the normal sense, per se. So then you went through a whole clatter of procedure, and I noticed that one of the places you stayed in was up in Phibsborough, and it was run by civil servants. Tell us about that one.
Oh yeah, what happened was I got this job. I was just, I don't know what age I was, very, very young anyway. We were sorting bottles at the back of the, then it was called the Crofton Airport Hotel. Now it's called the Regency Hotel.
Mm.
We had a job, 2 shillings a day or something like that, sorting out bottles, beer bottles. And there was a window open and there was a watch on the ledge and I took it. It was just an old leather strap, small face lady's watch. And I ran away with it and sold it for a shilling or something. And I bought biscuits and tins of beans. And I had been camping previous to that. I had been camping. And I remembered where there was a scout's hut. And I got this idea. I'll run away there. There was a river nearby. I can get water from the river. Huckleberry Finn stuff. And I can live off the land. Like cabbage, I had this idea in my head. Cabbage and potatoes and carrots type of thing. So I ran away there and with my rucksack and my few bits and pieces. And of course, when I got there, when it became twilight and it started to get dark, the bats started flying. I was totally freaked out and I started to run home. I think I was crying as well. And of course, the police picked me up. What are you, young guy like you, doing out? And I told them about the watch. And so I was sent away to Marlborough House for a month.
And was that you told them that you'd stolen the watch?
Yeah, I more or less told them, you know.
And they didn't say, well, just watch it and don't do that again.
No.
Usually, I think on a first offence that they would now not.
Yeah, it was like, I don't know. I can't really remember the circumstances, Marion.
Right.
I just know I wound up, it's so long ago. I'm 63.
Right.
And this is like 50 years ago.
Yeah.
More than 50 years ago.
And when you were sent to this place called Marlborough House,
mm-hmm.
what did your man Da say to you?
I mean, they weren't too pleased with me. I can say that. They weren't too happy with me at all. And I mean, what could they do? I mean, you see, there was like trouble at home all the time. And
what kind of trouble?
Well, just a lot of drinking and rows and arguments and stuff like that all the time. And I guess I somehow rebelled or just became mischievous and just kept running away and stuff.
Right.
I mean, I kept running away all the time.
And what about your siblings? What happened to them?
They were okay. They were just getting on with things, you know. I was the eldest in the family, of course. And I suppose I became the surrogate father, really.
Right. Your dad had a serious drinking problem.
Yeah, he was a lot of men back then in the 1950s. I think everybody drank, you know, and drank to excess as well.
Mm.
And he was just one of them, you know. And it was accepted. It was the norm. I don't think it would be. Hopefully it would be accepted today.
And how did your mother deal with that?
If you can't beat them, join them type of thing.
Right.
You know, so, you know, it wasn't great.
Right. She had boyfriends separate to him, did she?
Yeah, she did, yeah. Yeah, I still love my mother, don't get me wrong, and I always will. And, you know, we all... None of us are perfect, you know, and I don't know what kind of a childhood she had.
Right.
You know, so everybody acts out their stuff. You've got to understand that. Like, there's nobody really bad.
Yeah.
You know, people don't do things deliberately. You know, one of the things I've learned over the years in recovery from clerical abuse and all that stuff, at one time I really felt, just get on with my life and forget about all that stuff. But you see, that was just ignorance. Feelings that are buried alive. They'll come back to haunt you. And it will manifest in your life, and especially anger. Anger is like a top layer emotion.
Right.
Like when I say top layer emotion, I'll give you an example. If you were hanging a picture on the wall and you missed a nail and hit your finger, your first reaction is anger. But the reason you're angry is because you're hurt. You know, but being a man, you're not supposed to cry. You're not supposed to feel hurt. But that's actually where the healing is. But we don't want to go there. So we go into denial.
Right.
And we tried to forget about it, as I say. But one of the ways it manifested with me was through panic attacks, anxiety attacks and depression. Now, it wasn't all the time, thank God. But every now and again, I'd have a major anxiety attack, panic attack.
How did that feel?
Oh, horrible. It's like you're going to die. It's either you're having a brain tumour or a heart attack or, you know, and you just get shaky and you go white and... You really think you're gonna die? It's quite scary, what that can do. And what happened to me was I wound up in Dangan,
yeah,
and run by the Oblate priests and brothers, and I suffered terrible abuse there. So I first started.
But you didn't suffer sexual abuse, sure you didn't.
Well, I did in a way because what happened was the paedophile, that I came in contact with was a brother. And I was kind of like segregated working in the church on my own. Like I wasn't out on the in workshops with other lads. I was totally on my own. And he had access to me like all the time. And he'd come down. And what he would do was, I didn't know this until I discovered this when I was about 35 by reading an article in a newspaper. But he was grooming me. But I didn't realise that he was grooming me. And he'd come down and he'd ask sexual questions. Always about masturbation. Did I masturbate? Like, I was 13 years of age. Like, did I masturbate? Of course, I'd say no. And whether I did or not, I can't even remember.
Yeah.
And I'd say no. And he'd say, do you ever see any other boys doing anything? And I didn't, being quite honest.
Right.
But, you know, a kid like that, being asked questions like that, there was a part of me, I don't know whether it was the spirit or some kind of intelligence or something, saying, never give this man an inch. So all I ever said was, yes, brother, and no, brother. You know, I tried to avoid conversations, anything to go over. There was a line I felt there that I just couldn't go over. So I just said, yes, brother, no, brother.
Weren't you lucky that you had that?
Yeah,
there was other kids. That self-preservation thing.
Yeah, but still and all, the mental torture, the emotional stuff, it was really subtle, if you like. But this went on for almost a year, I'd say a year and 3 or 4 months. And I think he realised that he was getting nowhere with me, that he couldn't break me. And I've always had a strong spirit, I still have today. And I think when he realised that he couldn't break me, the only way he could get me was if I'd done something wrong. So I got into a bit of a scuffle in the yard with another lad. No, just rolling around the ground. We couldn't hurt each other if we tried, I don't think. And as a result of that, they took me from the dormitory that evening and they just whipped me, like, you know, three of them. And I was completely naked. We used to wear this nightshirt. And I remember going back there to do a documentary with Tony McMahon, the accordion player, good friend of mine. Mm. And it was Tony at the point that I pointed that element of this out to me. He said, those nightdress you wear, that was really degrading. It was almost like something like a woman would wear, you know. We used to put a belt around it to take the look off it. And so anyway, they took me down and took the nightshirt off and I was completely naked. And I had to kneel at the steps on the ground and stretch my hands out on the third or fourth step, wherever they reached to. And another brother came over and stood on my fingers. And then the other guy, it took him forever to administer the... I used to call it a punishment, you know, because you think it's your fault, you know. I didn't see it as abuse at the time. And I also minimised later and I thought, well, I wasn't sexually abused. So, you know, it's what you do. I got away with the type of thing.
Yeah.
But I really didn't. So I was in denial for a long time saying, oh, you know, how we minimise, we say like it was worse for other people. It wasn't that bad for me. But it really was, you know. Yeah. So I had to come out of denial and admit like this stuff got to you. You were traumatised by this. And I mean, that didn't happen until I didn't even begin to look at that until I was 33. And that was a long process. The healing process was a long...
It sure was. And did none of you have any help? Did you... I mean, obviously you were down in the country, so I presume you didn't have any visitors from the family, did you?
Well, no, my mother was very good to me. My mother came to see me once a month.
Could you tell her they were beating
you? Oh, you couldn't, no. Well, you wouldn't worry your mother. You couldn't. Oh. Make matters worse. So... The funny thing, after the visits, it would be on a Sunday. He'd come in on Monday and he'd ask me all these questions. Did you see any girls on a visit? And I knew exactly what he meant. And I'd say, oh, I think I saw Tommy Sonso's sister was there. And did you feel anything? No. You know, did you have an erection? No.
Good
you know,
Lord.
And you know, it was horrible. And then one day he came into the sacristy to me and he had a letter inside his, is it a Cossack they call it? The big dress they wear.
And then cassock. I think a cassock is a Russian.
Yeah, is it? Sorry, so. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Anyway,
I could
like
be wrong. Anyway,
it looked like a dress, a black dress, and which suited him. Anyway, but he took the letter out and started whacking me across the face, and he said he was told that I kissed the boy in a handball. And he was just absolutely crazy. You know what I mean? I'm not a homosexual. If I was, I wouldn't have any problem with it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would. Anyway, but this was the accusation. And I remember crying that day. It was very hurtful, what he was suggesting. And I just kept saying, that's a lie, you know. And eventually, like, he stopped the whacking across the face.
So when you had been through all that in an institution, in a way, and I don't mean to impugn the army in any way at all, you decided when you came out to join the army,
yeah,
which would have been nearly like going from one rigid situation into another, but you loved it.
Well, be quite honest with you, I was a tough guy, you know, and if anyone had touched me at that age, I'd have bit the shit out of them. That's been quite honest with you. No, I was quite confident about how I'd handled myself in the army and stuff. And the army was fantastic. I really, one of the best times of my life. I was with like 49 other guys, and it was such a great bunch of guys. Fantastic. The training, it still stands to me today. I'm really fit, although I'm 63, I'm really fit. And, you know, I swim a mile nearly every day, and I walk my dog at night and stuff. And, you know, thank God I've come through it all. Like,
And if you come back around, one of the other reasons you went into the army because you thought you'd get into the music section.
Yeah, I wanted to join the army band. And when I, the recruiting sergeant told me when I went to join the army that once I'd done all the training, I could choose where I wanted to go. So I wanted to go into the army band and music, the army school of music. And so I'd done all the training, but when I went before the commanding officers, and he said where I wanted to go, I was 25, and he said, you have to be 16, you can't. Right. It's a 12-year commitment. And I said, I'll still come in for 12 years. But, and the funny thing was, so I didn't make the grade, and the funny thing was that when I'd be washing dishes, which I used to have to do sometimes, the number one army band would come in, and I'd start playing the harmonica, and they'd all go, that's brilliant, you know. And we're playing in such a place, why don't you come down and jam with us? And I really got on well with the lads, you know.
Yeah, music is just a thread going right through your life.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Right through your life.
Uh-huh.
And you've busked all over Europe and you did, I mean, uh-huh, all of that.
Yeah.
And how did it come to be your full-time life as opposed to something you loved?
I'll tell you a story. This story is very, very appropriate in my life, poignant. I was in a place called Shangannon Castle because I subsequently wound up being sent to... now, this was all happened before when I was 16. This stopped when I was 16, so it's not like love-hate, okay?
Okay.
So I don't know what I'd done, something stupid anyway. I wound up in St. Patrick's Institution. I was only there a while, and then he put me down to Shangannon Castle, which is a place out in Bray. It's an open rehabilitation place for young lads. And while I was there, I mean, I was a right tearaway, to be quite honest, and full of mischief and stuff. But I went out on a work detail one day, and we were kind of digging a field or a garden, and there was a big tree there. It was a chestnut tree, and I just put the pick I was using against the tree, climbed up the top, and the officer came along. They were plain clothes and all that. They're very nice people down there. And he said, "Where's Baker?" And of course, the lads wouldn't squeal or tell, and he kind of figured out where I was, and he called up the tree, come down. I was up smoking up the tree, come down. I eventually come down anyway, make a long story short. But he put his arm around me and he said, "You know what would happen if you fell off that tree?" He said, "You'd probably break your neck or your legs. You'll wind up in hospital." And he said, "I'd lose my job. I've three small kids. I'll be out of work." He said, "Is it really worth it, you know?" He said, "I'll be a good lad and go on back to work." So he didn't put me on report. I didn't get a box in the ear. So I went to bed that night thinking, that guy's right. And that was a huge turning point for me.
Isn't it interesting how kindness, mm-hmm, can be undoing in many ways?
And the other thing that affected me, I remember watching the film Good Will Hunting, and towards the end there's a scene where Robin Williams, the mathematician, the genius, I forget the actor's name, but he's trying to get through to him how he's acting out of stuff, like getting into fights and being angry and all that, because he was so abused by his father and so hurt. But of course, he's in denial as well. But Robin Williams puts his arms around him, keeps saying, "It wasn't your fault, it wasn't your fault." And he breaks down. And that was something that touched me as well. I thought, that's where you need to go. That's where the healing is.
Yeah.
And that is where it is. But you see, Marion, I grew up with what I call the John Wayne syndrome. Like John Wayne's in the ditch shooting Indians, and the woman's loading the rifle for him. And then smack, he gets an arrow in the chest and he just breaks it off and he says, "It's just a scratch. You know, men don't feel."
Yeah.
And keep loading the rifle for me there. And he takes the scarf from around his neck and tucks it under his chest, and his eyes are closing and he's dying, but he's not hurt. he's okay, you know.
Yeah.
He wouldn't admit he was hurt. And I call it the John Wayne syndrome. And big boys don't cry. We just have heart attacks, you know.
Yeah. And the, I was just amused there to see something coming in saying, for God's sake, tell Don to tell the scriptwriters in Fair City to give you a nicer part. We don't like to see you as a gangster. And that comes from a fan. The other thing that I find very interesting is that you retained your faith right through all that.
Time,
now,
yeah.
A lot of people who've had a hard time dealing with priests and brothers who were cruel to them lost their faith, but you held on to yours.
Well, you see, Marion, I wouldn't be religious in any way, shape or form. The difference between religion and spirituality, religion teaches you what to think. Spirituality teaches you how to think. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Like, in other words, spirituality would say, well, what do you think? What's your opinion? What's your view? There's no brainwashing with it. There's no conditioning. You know, you're free to choose.
Do you believe in God?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I believe in a higher power. And I pray a lot, you know, and I meditate a lot. And it's a great help, really is, you know. And I read a lot of stuff. One of the books I've read that was very, very helpful to me was a book by a Jesuit priest, Father Anthony de Mello. He was from Bombay. He was an Indian priest, and he wrote a book called Awareness. And he says, what you're aware of, you're in control of, but what you're not aware of is in control of you. So that made perfect sense to me, because like all the stuff we spoke about, like the years go by, you get on with your life. But like I said, feelings are buried alive. It's in the subconscious.
Right.
So therapy is great for bringing that to the fore, up to your conscious mind. So it's only then that you can deal with it. Like it might be quite painful, but if you're willing not to take Valium or not to take alcohol and stick with the feelings. And it really is like the opposite of what we've been taught as men, that big boys don't cry and stuff. Like I discovered it takes a hell of a lot more courage to feel your feelings than not to feel them. So the John Wayne thing is completely gone with me.
Out.
Yeah.
So you're now acting. I mean, mm-hmm. Films, Fair City, the music, things going well.
Things are brilliant. The new album is only out about a week now. It's called My Songs, My Friends. And I think it was guided to that as well. And I was in recording and I met this young girl, Clara Rose, her name, fantastic singer. I was in looking at a guitar in a music shop and she came up to me and presented me with her album. I listened to her album and subsequently I asked her to come into the studio and sing one of my songs. And then Stuart Gray, who's a fantastic engineer and musician, I was working with him. He also engineered the sessions.
Yeah.
He suggested, after listening to Clara, we get other people in. So I approached Finbar Fury, who's one of my best friends, and I knew I could rely on him. So Finbar came in and sang a song. And then I think I asked Damien Dempsey, and Damien came in. And it just went from there. And then Brian Kennedy happened to walk in to a studio. My good friend Billy Farrell was mixing some of the tracks, and he heard a song. He said, who's that? And Billy told him all about the project. And he said, will you ask Don, could I sing one? So I had a song for Brian, as it so happened. And it just grew from there. So I wound up with 14 artists on the album. It's called My Songs, My Friends. And it's great. I'm delighted with it.
Well, congratulations on it. And you are going to say, what your one on this, I thought, was called Maureen, was it not?
Well, what happened, Marion, was I recorded about 22 tracks.
Right.
And I've only used 14 on the album.
Right. So what you're going to do, Lord of Mercy.
Yeah, this is one that on the album I do. This is a duet I do on the album with Eleanor McAvoy. Of course, Eleanor's not here this morning. Hello, Eleanor, if you're listening. You're great on the album. Thank you.
I hope she is.
So I'll do this on my own. Rough and ready now this morning, just with the acoustic guitar.
Love to hear it. Well, I know you musicians hate the whole business of having to do anything in the morning, really, because you don't come to life until much later in the day. But we look forward to this as he puts on his harmonica and takes up his guitar. That was absolutely lovely, Don. And thank you very, very much indeed. It's My Songs, My Friends. That's from that album. But listen, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to us this morning.
1850 715 150.